tell me about Ike.
he was one of my favorites, because when they a friend of his saw me in South Africa, and he told Ike, if he would ever come to the United States, to come and look me up. And Ike's mother brought him to me when he was about 19, I guess. Right. And I put him in the Golden Gloves, and he won everything. He won the state and went to the Nationals, and he didn't do too well in the Nationals, but we turned pro. And he just was a fine student. You know, he learned real fast, and he wanted you to teach him something new every day. So we had a good relationship. I was an athlete, and I could play baseball, I could play basketball, I could box. And I tell people about boxing, you can play baseball and you can play basketball, but you can't play boxing. It was. All the guys were good and capable of being world champions. You know, they just had to stand in line and wait their turn. And I tell these young guys today, they rush these guys to the championship, and they don't even know how to throw a jab. They don't even know what it's about. And, you know, and they don't have their PhDs. I think we did.
Yeah.
We had our PhDs before we learned when we won the championship. It was different.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tris Dixon.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
Still a goosebumps to this day.
Just, you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He's one that boy in back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning and there's nothing else.
Hello, this is a bonus edition of Boxing Life Stories. It's hard to explain what I've gone through looking for this interview, but fair to say I found this interview that I did with Curtis Cox back at his home in 2010. I was in Dallas for Manny Pacquiao's fight with Joshua Clotty. I'd actually gone out to see Donnie Fleeman, who had fought Muhammad Ali and Ezzard Charles back in the day. And Donnie wasn't in at the agreed time. I went and got him a couple of days later. But I had some time to kill, and I wound up somehow with Curtis Cox's address. So I drove over to Curtis's house and I door knocked him. And then what took place then was this sort of rather impromptu 20-minute interview with Curtis, talking about his life and times in boxing, in and out of the ring. I thought that this interview had gone for good. I've even looked through the Boxing News archives trying to find where and when I published it in 2010. Now, I was in the eye of a storm of a really horrible divorce at the time, so maybe it never saw the light of day. However, on this laptop where I found this audio, I have found the written piece, not the photo of Curtis outside the front of his house, which I'm sure I took, but obviously not finding the piece and subsequently having no trace that I've ever spoken to Curtis, and I'm sort of second guessing everything, but I'm sure I took a picture of him outside his house. The reason this is so timely is obviously Curtis has just passed away in the last few days, and so I wanted to put this out there so that people could hear what a nice guy he was. This is a Hall of Fame boxer, an International Boxing Hall of Fame boxer, who's welcomed me in off the streets with no appointment, no phone call, nothing set up, nothing arranged, made me feel welcome, and proceeded to go through all the questions I could think of on the spur of the moment. Obviously, this isn't the usual or the usually prepped Boxing Life Stories. This was done 10 years ago, not with a long podcast in mind, but with an 800-word Where Are They Now piece in mind. Sometimes you could get away with 10 minutes for a Where Are They Now piece, or even less than that. So this is longer than that and shorter than the normal podcast. But like I said, I'm pleased to be able to put this out there, finally, having found it. And I was pleasantly surprised with the audio quality as well. There's also a few other audios that I've found in amongst the 3,500 documents, clips and so forth. So I might be able to bring some back down the line. We'll have to see, but safe to say I'm pleased that we've been able to capture Curtis. I think his health declined shortly after this, and I know that subsequent journalists who tried to speak to Curtis weren't allowed to because his health had deteriorated so badly. So I was pleased to get him on a day where he was fine, and it was a pleasure to spend time with him. And it's always a privilege when these guys have gone to say that you met them and that you spent time with them, and especially privileged that they were so pleasant to you and that they invited you in and made you so welcome, as you can hear in Curtis's voice. A reminder, this podcast wouldn't be happening without Delco Safety Compliance and Hanson Lee Resourcing, my two lead sponsors, terrific guys who have helped me through thick and thin. This isn't this week's podcast. This is an additional episode. We should be back tomorrow with a full length, or we should be back with a full length episode this week. But I did want to put this interview with Curtis out in the public domain. I hope you enjoy it. And how here is the legendary International Boxing Hall of Fame inductee, Curtis Coakes.
Okay, so tell me a bit about, you know, how you got into boxing and stuff, if that's okay.
Okay, yeah, well, I got into boxing because it was during the summer months when we were out of school, and it wasn't too many things for me to do to keep me busy. And so I went to the YMCA, and they had a boxing team. And I decided to, you know, just to mess around with them during the summer period. And really didn't care too much about boxing, but I was a baseball player and basketball player. But in the summer, it wasn't too much to do, so I went up there to box and train with the guys just to get in shape. And then after, you know, I got out of high school and everything, I was too small to play baseball. You know, I was in the Dodger chain and I didn't make it.
Yeah.
And I was too short to play basketball. So I decided to go back to boxing.
Sure.
Where I could hit somebody my size so I can compete with people my own size. And that's what turned me into boxing.
Were there any fighters that you looked up to back then?
Yeah, Ray Robinson. I used to love to watch Ray Robinson, Carmen Basilio. Those guys were great fighters to me.
Yeah.
Carl Bobo Olsen was a fighter. He was just a little bit before me, and I used to enjoy watching him.
Sure, okay. So who would you say was the best you fought in your career? Because, you know, there's a lot of big names when you look through your record.
Well, I guess that Jose Nopales was probably the best fighter that I fought, because he defeated me twice.
Yeah.
And nobody else ever could do that.
Yeah.
So I thought he was great, one of the greatest fighters that I fought. Luis Rodriguez is another great fighter that I fought.
You fought him twice too, didn't you?
I fought him three times.
Three times.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Manny Gonzalez is also one of the guys that I thought was a great fighter. That he really helped my career to graduate, because he was a great fighter when I fought him, and that was my first pro fight.
Yeah.
And I fought Manny Gonzalez, and he was a National Gold Glove champion. So that was a big step in my direction as far as my career was, you know, climbing up the ladder. And I fought him five times.
Yeah.
And I beat him four out of five. So we had a good relationship. We were good friends in and out of the fight.
Yeah.
The ring, yeah.
So tell me about Luis Rodriguez, because, you know, he's one of the guys I always like to watch, you know, when you get out the black and white tapes.
Well, you know, Luis was a great guy. You know, he when I retired, my brother boxed Luis Rodriguez in Miami, and Luis beat him.
Right.
And I was there, so I told him after the fight, I said, "Well, I'm coming out of retirement, man. We're gonna fight again."
Family revenge.
Yeah, but they never got to fight together. So
sure.
But he was just a tremendous fighter. You know, he fought bigger guys better than did guys his own size.
Yeah.
You know, Luis could beat the middleweights in the super middleweights better than he could the welterweights.
Yeah. Okay.
So he fought big guys better.
What made you call it a day when you finished?
Well, I was over in South Africa, and I was standing up talking to a guy, and he was on my right side, and I didn't see him, and he touched me, and I didn't see him, so I knew I had a bad eye. So, and when I came back home to Texas, I went to the doctor, and they said I had a detached retina, and I didn't fight no more after that.
How hard was it having to stop? Especially when you bear in mind it wasn't really your choice if it was.
Well, you know, really, it I could have probably, you know, after I got my eye fixed, it was fine. I could have continued to fight, but I could see myself slipping,
yeah.
And I wasn't doing the things that, and boxing wasn't fun anymore. It was hard work.
Sure.
And once it became hard work, then I didn't want to do it anymore. Because when it was fun, then I enjoyed doing it and I could do it well. But then when you have to struggle to do well, then I figured that was time to go. I don't think a fighter should ever have somebody else to tell him that he needs to quit. I think you should be. Okay, I'm talking right now. I don't think you should have anybody to tell you to retire. You should make that decision yourself.
Yeah, okay. Why do you think so many fighters find it hard to find the right time to quit?
Well, most fighters don't want to give up the glory. I see guys today fighting, and they're fighting way past the time. And they're just in the way of young guys trying to come up the ladder. They're just standing in the way.
Yeah.
Making a dollar here, not performing good. And, you know, and a lot of fighters just don't have anything else to do.
Sure.
So, but you have to find something else to do. You just can't be a one-track man. I mean, you know, boxing, I chose boxing. Boxing didn't choose me. So I could do something else other than box.
Did you go straight into training after when you finished, or did you have other jobs and stuff?
Oh yeah, I had jobs. I worked at a meat packing company when I got ready to fight for the title.
Right.
I was working.
Yeah.
And they allowed me to leave my job and go and then come back and still had a job, but I didn't need that after I won the title, so I didn't go back.
Fair enough. What about when you retired? Because I mean, you started training fighters, didn't you? And you trained.
Yes, I did. I started training fighters not right after I retired. I worked for a car dealership.
Okay.
And I was in charge of the tire department.
Right.
For about 3 years, and then that got a little dull for me, and so I started training fighters, and I made it work because I was traveling all over the country training fighters, and I started a lot of young guys' careers, and I started to enjoy it. So
yeah,
I just kept doing it. Yeah.
Who were some of the better guys that you trained?
Well, Richard Johnson, I started him.
Right.
Kurt Johnson, Ike Abiabuchi, Quincy Taylor.
Okay, tell me about Ike.
he was one of my favorites because when they a friend of his saw me in South Africa, and he told Ike if he would ever come to the United States to come and look me up, and Ike's mother brought him to me. When he was about 19, I guess. Right. And I put him in the Golden Gloves, and he won everything. He won the state and went to the Nationals, and he didn't do too well in the Nationals, but we turned pro. And he just was a fine student. You know, he learned real fast, and he wanted you to teach him something new every day. So we had a good relationship.
Yeah. Were you with him all the way through until he went to prison?
Yes. He was 20-0, yeah, with me. He started with me, amateur with me, and he turned his... turned pro with me, and he was 20-0 when they put him in jail.
How good could he have been?
He could have been still champion of the world.
Really?
Yeah. He was such a a hard worker, and he was dedicated and
tough as
yeah. He
as well.
he just had that the way they live over there. You can't do those things over here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, if they kidnap somebody in Africa, they don't do nothing about it. But here, you get a life sentence.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Okay. What was your career highlight, you know, in the ring?
I think when I won the world's title, because they put me in at a time when I was, 29 years old, and they thought that they put me in with Luis Rodriguez, so it'd be an easy fight for Louis, and I upset him, and that was the best win of my career. I think the second time that I. The third time that I fought Louis.
Okay. Did you always think you could be a champion?
When I went to the gym the first time and started sparring, that was my goal, was to be a world champion. I worked at trying to become a champion, not just a fighter.
Yeah.
I was working for the world's title. Every time I would train, my trainer would tell me, "Say, I'm not training you for the fight you fight. I'm training you for the world championship."
Yeah.
And this is part of the process you have to go through to be Jeez. Become world champion. So that's what I kept that in my mind. And I tell my young fighters the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm not training you to win this fight. I'm training you to be a champion of the world.
Yeah.
So we're way above what we're trying to do today.
How many fighters are you training at the moment?
Only one that Kurt Johnson I still have.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I still train Kurt. And then my amateur program is handled by my son. So
What's your son's name?
It's Vincent Coates.
Sorry,
What's his name? Vincent.
Vincent.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any regrets about your career?
No, I really don't, because it was. You know, I think that I did something most people probably could not do, because I was not allowed to fight in the Golden Gloves because it wasn't integrated during that time. So I had to watch the guys fight in the Golden Gloves, but I could have beaten all of them.
Yeah, do you mean like racially integrated?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And so I could not fight here. I wanted to represent my country in the Olympics, but I wasn't able to fight, so I couldn't. You know, qualify for the Olympics.
Yeah.
So that was a bad taste in my mouth, and it still is today. But I forgot about that after I became champion. And you know, you didn't have to go through the amateur program to be a world champion.
Yeah.
People thought that was almost impossible. But I never fought an amateur fight.
Sure. Okay.
My first fight was a pro fight. So
really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. How were you before a fight with pre-fight nerves? Because you know, a lot of people obviously struggle with you know, the day of the fight and it being in the changing room before the fight. I know it's okay when the bell goes, but how are you like in the...
Well, it really didn't bother me, because that's what I was there for, was to fight. You know, I played basketball and basketball on a big stage, and I played baseball on a big stage, and crowds didn't bother me. You know, I just went in and I blacked them out, you know, and I, you know, they could cheer or they could boo, but I didn't hear them.
Yeah.
I was watching the guy in front of me.
Okay, let me sling some names at you. Can you tell me about the some of the guys that you fought, if that's okay?
Okay.
Kenny Lane.
Kenny Lane. That was a fight that Kenny Lane was lucky to get a draw with. I beat him really pretty bad right here in Dallas.
Yeah.
And he was a left-hander, and I used to eat up left-handers. They didn't bother me at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about Joe Michele?
Who?
Joe Michele from New York.
Joe Michele.
Yeah.
He was an old veteran when I fought him. I was a young guy coming up, and he was an old veteran on his way out.
Just like a crossroads fight.
Yeah, and so I was just glad that he didn't knock my head off. He was a tough guy.
Yeah.
But that was a big fight for me.
Okay, how about, I went and interviewed him in Philadelphia a few years ago, but
Stanley Haywood?
Yeah.
Every time I go to Philly, you know, Stanley always come by.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I had fighters up there, he would always come by the hotel and we'd sit and chat. But, you know, that fight was, I had just gotten married. I was married 10 days before that fight. And I was still on my honeymoon, so, but that was a bad time to take a honeymoon and go into a fight with Stanley Haywood.
Yeah.
But they still say that was one of the best fights they've seen in Philly.
Yeah, it was a real tear-up, wasn't it?
Yeah, every time you go there, they're showing that fight in Philadelphia, so... That was a good fight.
Yeah.
You know, but although he didn't win a championship, but I did, so we talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, he fought some good guys as well, though. Didn't
he?
He
did.
Bill Griffith and
a
few other tough guys.
Yeah, he sure did.
So, and what about Gene Jocelyn, who you unified the titles against?
Jocelyn and I became pretty good friends. He invited me to Paris. And we did some exhibitions over there to raise money for the underprivileged children in Paris, and we became good friends.
Really?
I fought him twice.
Yeah.
And the last time I fought him, I beat him pretty bad. Beat him really bad. It wasn't a title fight. It was just a non-title fight. But even after that, we became friends. And we boxed the exhibition, and I was 63, 64 years old when we boxed the exhibition. And I think he was trying to get even, because he was really pumping. Yeah. The crowd was really cheering for him.
Yeah. So another Philly guy who boxed in New York, Gypsy Joe.
Gypsy Joe was—he had the best reflexes of any man I've seen in my life. He could make you miss punches just about an inch, you know, if he wanted to. But he couldn't make 47. He was a bigger guy. When I fought him, He was a middleweight and I was a welterweight, and I still think I beat him. You know, when you lose a fight, you know it.
Yeah.
Yo.
Hey, man.
What's happening?
All right, how's it going?
Okay.
Yeah, so how good was Gypsy Joe? Because he never got the chance to fulfill his potential, did he?
No, he didn't, because the guy really, he had a bad eye. He couldn't see well.
Hmm.
And he was just a freak of a fighter. You know, I don't think he would have lasted long as, you know, fighting with top boys all the time, because I busted him up, but although he got a decision, it was real close, 4-5-1 or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. What about Charlie Shipes?
Charlie was a good fighter, and he had a reputation. At the time that I fought him, they said he was a California welterweight champion, and that was the only state that I didn't have under my belt as world champion. The state of California, they didn't recognize me,
right.
But they recognized Charlie. So George Foreman was a really good friend of Charlie's, and in fact, Charlie started training George Foreman later on in his career. But that fight was a big fight for me and a big fight for Charlie, but it ended up being an easier fight for me. I didn't have any problem with Charlie.
Yeah. How good has boxing been to you, and you know, in terms of your life in boxing, has it been something that's kept you fulfilled throughout life?
Yeah, because you know, people call me. I get thousands of letters a month from people that want autographed pictures or just a sign of a card for them, and they haven't forgotten about me. In fact, I just had a story in the Boxing Digest, a story written about me. I didn't even know it, but I just picked a book up and there it was.
Yeah.
But and people always call me for advice about young fighters as they're training, and I enjoy that, but boxing has been my life.
Yeah. Do you think you made the right choice? You know, what you say, you chose boxing didn't choose you. Are you pleased with the choice?
Yes, I am, because the things that I really wanted to do was to play baseball. That was my first love, and I was a shortstop. I thought I was great.
Yeah.
But when I got to the major leagues and saw those big guys throwing the ball 100 miles an hour, I thought, I got to find something else to do. And so I chose boxing because it was, guys was my own size. And
yeah.
And I think I made a good choice. I was an athlete. And I could play baseball, I could play basketball, I could box. And I tell people about boxing, you can play baseball and you can play basketball, but you can't play boxing.
No.
See, so it's a serious business, serious game. So I had to get my mindset to be really serious about boxing if I want to be a boxer.
Sure.
And for 15 years, that's what I did.
How rewarding is it for you now when you look up and see the belt?
I show people. A lot of people come by. Like we have a guy that's doing some work here for us, and he didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of what I did, and I'm proud of the belt, so I showed it to him. And he didn't. Next day he came in. He come and shadow boxing at me. So. So.
Do all the people around here know who you are?
Oh yeah, because yeah. I've been here so long. Yeah.
Yeah. How long have you lived here?
Well, I bought this house from my mother in 1967.
Really?
Okay. And now I'm living in it with my sister and one of my other brothers. We stay here.
Sure. Okay. Have you been married?
Yes, 3 times.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's enough. I got knocked out all 3 times.
Jeez. And how about kids?
I have 6.
Okay.
I have 6 kids.
Are they in the area?
Yes. My son is here. One of my sons is here. My other son is running the gym. He's at the gym. I have 4 daughters and 2 boys.
Okay.
And one of my daughters is an attorney. She finished Ohio State University.
Really?
So,
okay.
Yeah. So.
Do you still watch the fights now?
I've watched some of the fights. I don't watch, you know, like Friday night fights.
Yeah.
If it's somebody on there that I know, or a trainer that has a fighter, I'll sit and watch that. I watch the big fights. You know, I'm supposed to go out and sign autographs before the Pacquiao fight.
Yeah, sure. Are you going to go to that fight?
I don't know if we are going to be able to get in there or not, but I'm signing autographs before the fight.
Yeah, okay.
So.
All right. Okay, well, I mean, is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you think I should have?
Oh, well.
What was the worst moment? Was there a low in your career, you know, when you were fighting, you know, a bad decision or a bad loss, you know, something that really devastated you at the time?
Well, you know, I took one beating, I think, in my whole career, and that was the fight with Jose Nopolis.
Yeah.
Because my face was swollen, my eyes was closed, and that's the worst licking I ever took in a fight, you know, only bruises that I had in a fight.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of fights. Losing the title and trying to regain the title, I just didn't have the spark anymore, because I won the title, and that's as far as you can go. Win the title, so you kind of let down a little bit sometimes. You think that because you're champion, you should be able to do certain things, but if you don't work hard to do those things, you're not going to be able to do it. So I was disappointed in my performances against Jose Nopalis.
Yes,
yes. Yeah.
Okay. Is there anyone that you didn't fight that you would like to have fought?
Emil Griffin. I wanted to fight him, and we were pretty close at one time.
Yeah.
But his management team wouldn't allow him to fight me because I was a counterpuncher. Emil came right at you. And I boxed with one of his cousins in New York in a sparring session, and Emil was there. And the kid, when he got out of the ring, he told Emil, he said, "Emil, he's too smart." And it made Emil mad.
Yeah.
But when I go to the the Hall of Fame,
I
see Emil all the time. And I was in New York one time with a fight, and Emil passed by, and we recognized each other. So,
yeah.
But we all friends. I mean, I don't have any bad taste in my mouth about any fighter.
It was a great era, though, wasn't it, for you? In terms of there were so many good fights. I mean, another guy that you fought, we didn't talk about, Stan Harrington, but there's so many. It was a really deep division at the time, wasn't it?
It was. All the guys were good and capable of being world champions. They just had to stand in line and wait their turn. And I tell these young guys today, they rush these guys to the championship, and they don't even know how to throw a jab. They don't even know what it's about. They don't have their PhDs. I think we did.
Yeah.
We had our PhDs when we won the championship. It was different.
If someone hadn't seen you on tape, how would you, apart from being a counterpuncher, how would you describe yourself as a boxer? And is there anyone that you've seen who has a similar style to you?
I haven't seen anybody yet that had my style, because it was a style I guess made for me, because nobody. These guys today just go and hit.
Yeah.
And it's about defense and offense at the same time. So, and I was a counterpuncher, and that was a better way for me to fight.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't go and just push somebody around. I had to outthink him and outsmart him.
Who taught you that?
One of my trainers named Robert Valencia.
Right.
He showed me how to counterpunch, and I showed Ali some stuff like that.
Really?
How to counter a jab. And in Ali's career, he was doing that. He was throwing right hands over jabs.
Yeah, definitely. He did that countless times against George Foreman, didn't he, in the jungle as well?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, I mean, I really appreciate your time. It's great to be able to stop by and
say
hello.
Thank you for coming, Ali.
So, like I said, that was more than 10 years ago now when I went to Curtis's home. His health did falter, I understand. Obviously, it's ironic, really, that my podcast with Kitten Hayward, his old opponent, has recently gone up. Curtis was, I think, 73 years old at the time of this recording. Obviously, it was good to talk to him about Ike Iwabuchi, his sort of star student, as it were, his own career, some big nights, and stuff away from boxing, be it family, jobs he's had. He's certainly got that old school mentality that you can sort of really appreciate and admire. And again, you sort of go back to this. If there was a soccer Hall of Fame, or with a baseball Hall of Fame, would these guys allow you just to door knock them, come off the streets and say, "Hey, I'm a journalist from the UK. How about giving me some time?" It's unlikely. Not impossible, but unlikely. And Curtis was just typically one of those down-to-earth guys. I went to his house in suburban Dallas, probably about 20 minutes on the outskirts of Dallas. And there we go. And that was it. So 20-odd minutes with the late, great Curtis Coakes. Privileged to be able to find that and bring it back to you guys. I hope you enjoy it. Some really interesting stuff in there. And thankfully, I've managed to find that and a whole bunch of other stuff. Thoughts and prayers are with Curtis's loved ones and everyone who has benefited from his knowledge, wisdom, and his fights from over the years. By all means, pull out some of the Curtis Coates classics on YouTube. Hope you enjoy this. A reminder, that this wouldn't be happening without Hanson Lee Resourcing and Delco Safety Compliance, who allow me to bring these podcasts to you. This isn't a full episode for this week, but this is everything that I have on the late, great Curtis Coakes.